Welcome to the Eastman Dental Podcast, where we hope to inspire, motivate, and provide education from our guests' experience.
Well, Julia, what a great episode with Nishma Sharma there.
Yeah, a lively career journey that lady's had.
She's worked for all sorts of organisations, and it was great to hear about her time with the Office of the Chief Dental Officer, as well as working for NHSE. There was a lot of different things that she's done.
Yes, and the passion for diversity in dentistry was really palpable.
And I think it was really inspiring for her to be so candid about her own experience and her own struggles.
So sit back and listen to this lively episode.
With your hosts, Josh Hudson and Julia Bruin.
So Nishma, thank you for joining us on the podcast. Let's start the same way that we always kind of end up starting, which is going back to the start of your career. So I'm intrigued. You've done a lot of things, but where did it all start? How did you end up getting into dentistry?
All right. So thank you for inviting me both. I started by, how did I get into dentistry? So that is a big one. I didn't choose to go into dentistry, it might surprise you, actually. I think it's the same story for a lot of people of a certain generation, of a certain ethnic background, whereby my idea of fun was to go into law. So that's what I wanted to do. That's where all my strengths were. That's where I was good at English at school. I was good at the languages. I was good at the arts, the humanities, not maths or sciences so much. So I went into dentistry for fear of purely a fear of disappointing my parents. My sister had gone into dentistry. I remember really making up my mind and knowing that I wanted to go into law. And my options, because at that point, at that time, you had to get things signed off by your parents. And so I'd chosen my A-levels. And it just literally was an absolute veto. And it was just a look of disgust. And it was, you don't write things like that down. You pass it by us and you will do chemistry, biology, maths, and that's the end of it. Which was heartbreaking, and it was a horrible. I just didn't understand. I was like, "But I'm not strong with those. I'm not good with those. I'm good at the bits that I'm good at, and I really want to go into law." But my parents were very much it's either medicine or dentistry, and it's at that time, you know, as a, 16-year-old, and that's another talk altogether. Why at the age of 16 we're choosing, you know, life careers. Mm. Do we really know our head from our ass? Not really. And it's one of those where you are now going to have to make a decision when I can't even, you know, buy a house or get a mortgage or know what the world is about your, what you're going to do for the rest of your life. So I didn't understand their decision making. I do now. Looking back, I completely get it. And I get why they were doing what was best for me. They had my best interests at heart always. And that's something that as you get older, you realise that your parents will always, no one's going to love you like your parents, but you can't understand them. And at that time you think, ugh, parents, oh, so old, don't understand anything, don't know nothing. But it was because of them. They were of that generation of the 70s and 80s. They dealt with the masses of racism in this country. My dad is by far one of the most intelligent people I know, by far. And he, all his qualifications were Indian based. So when he came over here, he wasn't able to reach his full potential by any means, but he did the best he could. He was ahead of his union and the such like, and he had a very strategic look on life. And he felt that there's no way I would have got anywhere in the law world, because if you can't see it, you can't be it. And at that point, there were no brown faces in law. There was no brown faces in government. There were no brown, you know, brown politicians. So he just thought, let's just leave that arena to white people, because you're never going to be welcome there. You're never going to make it there. You're never going to get anywhere. And let's focus on medicine and dentistry and ophthalmics and pharmacy, where a lot of the people he would look to, so, you know, a lot of family members, a lot of people in the community had their kids going into that. So he was doing it to protect me, but I couldn't see at the time. And I would have been the best lawyer in the world. I mean, oh my God. But it wasn't to me.
You weren't ever tempted, having done dentistry, to then go down the legal side alongside dentistry?
It's the oddest thing. On Tuesday, somebody, I went to the Dental Leadership Network and I was speaking to some people there. And it is something that this week, again, I looked into, maybe I need to do, I would love to do a law degree. I would love to do something dental legal based.
I have a patient of mine who is a, well, was, up until very, very recently, a part-time dentist and a part-time lawyer, and carried on way into what I would consider an age where perhaps people would be stopping working. He was continuing to work in dentistry and in law. So, you know, it can definitely be done.
It can, it can. I looked at it around 2008, 2009, and then I became pregnant fabulously. So it was just off the cards, and then never looked back at it again. So it is something. But when I say, why did you do dentistry? I went to dentistry purely not to disappoint, my parents. So it wasn't the choice that I wanted to make. I did an A-level. They allowed me to do an extra A-level. So I did, I mean, did I do 4.5 A-levels? I did one in English Lit because I knew I could do it. I knew I could easily do it. And the only concession was you can do it, but you, the minute your other grades stop falling, you have to give it up. So yeah, lo and behold, I did my A-levels, which is incredibly hard. A-levels are bloody hard. And then washed up on the shores of Guy's St Thomas's back in 98 with Spice Girls and Insomnia in the background.
I think that's really interesting. From what you were saying at the start there about not necessarily wanting to go into dentistry to now seeing this real passion for dentistry. So I'm just intrigued as to, was there a turning point where you were like, actually, I think maybe this is something that I can do and do well and that I enjoy? And what aspects are there that now say, actually, do you know what? I'm a good dentist and I enjoy doing this.
Going through, to me, going to university to study a dental degree was, I was a square peg in a round hole. Mm-hmm. I spent 5 years just miserable. And I'd give anything to have that time again. But I just wasn't in the right headspace at all. I'm from a very humble background. And dentistry at that time was full of very wealthy students from schools that I'd never heard of, you know, very, you know, haberdashers and merchant tailors. And it was like, oh, wow, what is this? Flashy, flashy. I was from Beaumont Leeds in Leicester. And it was a complete different world. I mean, my background was, you know, you get high walking through the playground. It was really, there was just, there were fights left, right and centre. We lived in a two-up, two-down. It wasn't, there was nothing sort of glamorous about my background. But I knew no better. I did not know any better. And all of a sudden you're surrounded by students who have Prada handbags. It was like, wow, as a student. So I was in a culturally very different environment. I was in an environment where everyone was clever, whereas where I'd come from, I was like the cleverest. I was the SWAT. And now I'm surrounded by really intelligent people. And they're all studying dentistry because they're passionate about dentistry. And oh my God, I'm going to be like the best dentist. And, you know, my father did it and all of this. And I'm thinking, nope, none of this applies. None of this applies. So I struggled I had massive depression during my years at university. I think that manifested as I was a very prickly character. I wasn't particularly pleasant. I was very defensive. I just didn't want to do what I was doing. I hated it. But my God, the resilience for an 18-year-old going up to 23, going through a degree that she absolutely hated, hating every day, not understanding why she was there, struggling with depression and still getting through it, and getting through it really bloody well with some prizes and distinctions. I mean, I was amazing, but I didn't see that. I just didn't see that side to me. So at the time I thought, I've just got to get through this. I can't disappoint. I've got to get through this. And then I'm going to go off and do my law degree, and I'm going to go off and I'm going to write poetry, and I'm going to do all the bits that I wanted to do. English degree, that was another big one I wanted to do. And then you graduate and you're left with this burden of, I say burden, nothing compared to what the kids go through now, nothing, but a burden of student loans. Mm-hmm. And I did my VT, so foundation training, they call it now. And she was the game changer for me, my VT trainer, my ES. It was down in Brixton, high need, really...
Brixton, London.
Brixton, just, London, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it was my VT trainer, Sangeeta. She has no idea how much I need to thank her for, but she was... She turned it around for me. All of a sudden, being a dentist with my own little surgery and my own little nurse and my own little environment and the reception and my own little patients without a demonstrator, you know, breathing down my neck, I came into my own. I loved it. It was control. It was control freak. I'm a massive control freak. And I'm there thinking, this is my own little safedom and I know what I'm doing. I actually know what I'm doing. Massive learning curve. At that time, I think I was steered by my nurse. My dental team have always been a big part in my life. I've always been, so I did temp nursing throughout uni to get some money in. And so I completely get how nurses are treated. And the way I was treated when I did temping, honestly, it was brutal. And the very, very rare time that some arrogant dentist would take the time to ask what I, you know, how long you've been nursing for, and I would tell them a dental student, my God, the way they would change. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, what are you studying? What, you're actually going to be a dentist? Yeah, where? Guys. And they just change. And they treat you so differently. And you think, well, why can't you just treat anybody like that? Why does, you know, why are people like that? So I saw that inequality there. But yes, back to Sangeeta and working in Brixton, I knew, oh, I can do this. This is not so bad. And then you get addicted, don't you? You're getting addicted to prestige. You get addicted to status. You get addicted to money coming in all of a sudden. You know, I used to survive on a grand a term. How? I don't know. But it was a grand a term. And to then start earning, start coming into myself, being able to be more myself, it was, okay, I'll do this. I'll do this for a year. I'll get through foundation training. And then... I'll get an associate position, but I stayed on as Sangeeta. So I'll do another year and then I'm definitely going to leave. And then I'll do it another year. And then the next thing you know, you've got a mortgage and kids. So I could do the clinical side of it. You know, I was okay with that. I enjoyed the relationship with patients by far. That's what I enjoyed the most is meeting people that you would never meet normally in a normal setting. I think that's what turned for me. I wanted to get better clinically, and it was about practicing, i.e. practicing dentistry. And yeah, I became better at dentistry, and I thought I can do this. Mm-hmm. So the clinical side clicked for me.
So the clinical side has clicked, was clicking, has clicked, is clicking currently, but you are doing roles outside of clinical dentistry now. What made you decide to think, you know, I'm going to come out of doing full-time clinical work and do something non-clinical, if we can call it that?
I think when you first graduate, your biggest stresses are the clinical. And so you're there thinking, I'm just not as good as my VT trainer, my ES, who could literally prep within, you know, 30 minutes. And I was like, how do you do that? I was booking in ages. And so your stresses are clinical. I would brick it when I saw a patient in for emergency. I'm thinking, oh no, it's a hot tooth. I'm going to have to extubate. And I'd over and over in my head, and I just wasn't confident. And so your stresses initially at the beginning of your career are clinical stresses. As you start to get better at those, the stresses change. They become more based on patients, what you don't learn at dental school, massive element that's missing is not teeth. We can do teeth. We're great at teeth. We can, you know, make them look pretty. We can pull them out. We can clean them. We can do disease. We can do that. But we can't deal with the fleshy, horrible bit at the end, which is the patient. And it's that kind of patient management is the soft skills that need to come with being a dentist. And that's where you can get yourself into trouble. And that's where I did a few times. I've had my fair share of complaint letters, patients complaining because I don't know, at that time, I was talking to my nurse and she didn't like it whilst the treatment was going on, or we didn't ask them to, I don't know, one was about, she didn't ask me to use the mouthwash at the end of the procedure or whatever it might be, but I just didn't understand patients, their role in dentistry. So the stresses change. But finally, you can hone in on that and you sort yourself out there, and it became, for me, boredom, like sheer boredom and loneliness. We lived in central London, and we left to move out to Hertfordshire. I got married, so I met my husband at university as well. He's also a dentist. And we left to move to Hertfordshire. And to me, that was a big deal, leaving behind. For some reason, I needed to be close to Guy's Hospital. I needed to be close to King's. I needed to be close to London. And to move out into the sticks, I've got two very young children. I started practicing, but I was lonely with the four walls of dentistry. You might have a conveyor belt of patients, but it's you and your nurse that you might or might not get on with. And it just wasn't enough to sustain me. I was like, is this my life? Is it just drilling, filling, suction, repeat, drilling, filling, suction, repeat? It goes on, it goes on. Got toothache, got this, got that. There are lots of things, and there are lots of dentists that are happy clinically, because that's enough to sustain them. And you can upskill, which is what I then did, because I thought, there's this void, I'm feeling this void, what do I do to fill it? So I upskilled, I went on the Aspire course, lots of other courses out there. Having somebody like Richard Porter, who's always been a friend to me, he's always been a mentor, and then to go on the course and to learn what I learned, upskilling, how to do things properly. Then I went on a Botox and fillers course, because you do. The standard of dentistry changed. All of a sudden, I was able to do all the sexy stuff that was becoming fashionable at that time. So up until then, it was all about the root canals, and it was all about the preps and the such like. But then things exploded. It became about EMACs, became about porcelain, became about being able to do very minimally invasive dentistry and how to create predictable bonds and the such like. So that sustained me for a while, because I didn't shy away from, patients who wanted full set of veneers, I used to refer them on to a colleague. Now I was doing it. So I was like, this is exciting, right? This is exciting. But then I got bored again. And it happens. We get personality types in dentistry. We get perfectionist, type A, high achieving personality types in dentistry. And it doesn't matter if you're a dentist, it doesn't matter if you're a dental therapist, it doesn't matter. We just attract that type of person. And by definition, then, we need to sustain that type of person. And I mean, I would argue, I don't think you need straight A's to be a dentist. I think my current nurse at the moment, she could be a dentist. She could be a dentist. Why is there this barrier of she has to have these A's and all the rest of it? I know she could be a dentist. I think she'd be a bloody great one. But it is what it is. It's the nature of the beast. When you have these patient, this type of person coming into dentistry, we're going to get bored. And I think that's what's happening more and more as people look towards portfolio careering, which is what I started doing, is portfolioing. I'm thinking, I've got two options here. Either I leave dentistry altogether, and I clearly watch too much Homes Under the Hammer. And I thought, I'm going to buy some houses. Oh my God, I'm going to buy some houses. Look at that kitchen. I could do that. Or do I stay within dentistry? I believe in fate. Massively. And it was around that time where I signed myself up to the local LDC newsletter, and a lady called Amanda Borland had posted a job on there to be a clinical advisor for NHS England. So I thought, let's see what happens. Let's have a try. I'd love to work from home. Let's see if there's something that I could cut down a clinical day and do something like that. And that's where the journey outside of clinical began.
You then started to work for NHSE. And what kind of things did that role entail? What kind of things did you then get involved in as part of that?
So being a clinical advisor is, in order to study and swat up for the interview, because I had no idea the frameworks, thankfully. You only have an idea of the frameworks when you have to be, when you're on the receiving end of it, unfortunately. It's the performance management side of it. So if a patient, as many do, are aggrieved for whatever reason, they will write a letter of complaint that goes to NHSE complaints team. They then send that on to a clinical advisor, who would take a look at all the evidence and formulate a clinical opinion. That is then sent back, and most of the times it's, there's nothing to see here, move on. But if it is something that requires a little bit more exploring, it would be escalated to the PAG, which is a performers advisory group, which I also sat on as a discipline-specific practitioner. So it's formed of four different people. And if it is something that is really quite worrisome and requires, a lot more thought, maybe consideration of removal of a practitioner, for instance, from the performers list. It gets escalated to the PLDP, which I also sit on as well. So that reading up of the framework and how it all works was eye-opening. And what I noticed was how little we as dentists really know about the system in which we work. We know sweet FA. We know nothing. We go into dentistry thinking we know dentistry. We don't. We sign up to the NHS thinking, well, it's got a great pension, but we know nothing about the way the system, the NHS system works. And it was at that time where I thought there has to be more. I want to know more. I want to know, well, you know, if you ask a practitioner on the ground, you know, what's an LDN? What's who decides your UDA rate? What is the actual contract value that you work under? Where were they founded? Who's in charge of, I don't know, they know regulation, I guess, the big bad GDC, right? Always the same answer. But what? Who's in charge of how many UDAs you're allocated, or who governs it? Who deals with the fraud side of things? How do you appeal? What does the BSA do? Who's in charge of the contract and the rubbish that we work under? They wouldn't have a clue. It would always end up with, well, it's probably the BDA, or it's probably OCDO, or it's, they haven't got a clue. So it was around that time where I'm asking all these questions. And what are we looking at? We're looking at 2012 now. Facebook, I just joined Facebook a few years ago. God, it sounds so old. I just joined Facebook a few years before that. And I became a member of the forums on Facebook. And realized just how much of my information I was getting from random people from Facebook. Where do you go for actual information, you know? So lo and behold, again, I was bored, but I started making a lot more contacts within that world. I saw a job posted to be a clinical fellow for the Office of the Chief Dental Officer. That was maybe 2 years later. When was that? It would have been 2016 or 2017, I want to say. So absolute zero chance of getting it, because what do I know? I'm just a person who's just working. I just work. I'm a mummy of two. I really don't have anything to offer, but I just wanted to go for it because I just wanted to meet the CDO, actually. That's the honest truth. I just wanted to meet. What is this? I mean, someone with such a ostentatiously titled chief dental office. Oh, my God, I want to meet this person. What do they do? What do they look like? So, I applied. And I was asked to come in for an interview. That was amazing.
I think all of these roles sound clearly fascinating and have stimulated you beautifully and have made you the person that you are. I do sense that there's a theme out there that this is you perhaps helping people. This is in a very different way than you were helping your patients. Yeah. So you were helping your patients, but now you're helping your profession, shaping it, developing it, and supporting them. Would that be fair to say?
Massively, yeah. I've always had an issue with injustice. I've always had an issue with unfairness. And that goes back to all sorts of childhood trauma. Another talk another day. But it's all sorts of, I hate the underdog. And to me, working within, I won't use the term gaslighting, because it's not appropriate, but there is hoodwinking, massive hoodwinking. When you go into dentistry with the best intentions in the world, especially when you work in the NHS, you are hoodwinked because you are forced to play a game where you don't know who the players are. You don't know what the rules of the game is. You have no idea what you're going into. You know what the ultimate goal is. The ultimate goal should always be the patient, right? And you know that's the ultimate goal, and we're good at that. But we're constantly being done to as a profession, constantly, because nobody explains the rules of the game. No one tells you how can you affect change. Why are we so rubbish as a profession at being influential? Why haven't we sorted out the contract from years ago? Why instead are we just punishing patients by leaving, which is what we're doing ultimately? We're punishing society by leaving. We're not punishing the commissions. They're literally sitting there and probably work out better for them. You know, it doesn't to me make sense whereby we start on a career, but we have no idea how we can sit around decision-making tables and affect change for good for our own mental health and well-being, our own businesses, which is what they are essentially, and for our working conditions. We just don't have it. We just don't have that ability. So, yes, I think it's time.
But I think we try, don't we?
Oh, we try. I mean, oh, I think, God, we try.
I think
we do try as a profession. We do try as a profession, but things like the schemes, like the clinical fellow scheme at the OCDO, or it took me having to get up and get out there and look for these positions. Otherwise, it's a network. The jobs will always go to people that they know. You know, if you're not in it, you're an outsider. I just think that it takes people to, you know, break in and say, I wanted to be a clinical reviewer because I want to be on the side of the practitioner. If you've got a PAG or, heaven forbid, you know, you've got some sort of performance management issue and there's four decision makers, only one is a dentist, you really want that dentist to kind of be on your side and see things in a way that you can see on the ground. Otherwise, again, we're just being done to. And you just accept that everything that is being, that you're being told is, that's it, there's nothing you can do about it. The angst that people face when it comes to, you know, being in breach of contract or having clawback or all these things, do they know the ins and outs of how that actually works? And can, would they know how to fight it if they felt that they had a case? These are the areas where I feel there are lots of holes in our knowledge.
And you're trying to help them.
Yeah, I want people to know the game, to understand it. Because I say game, but I use the term lightly because it's not a game. Is there's an end point, there are clear rules, and there's an element of fun. And I tell you, working in the NHS right now is anything but fun, right? So it's just not, it's not a game. These are people's livelihoods. So I feel the more that people are clued up on where accountability lies, who is the person who has the power to decide things, the better. And at the moment, it's just a select few that know these things. Everybody should know that.
Thank you.
So you mentioned injustice there and supporting your colleagues. And more recently, you've helped found the Diversity and Dentistry Action Group. You've also been involved in the Balance the Dental Boards group. I was just wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about that side of things and what's got you involved in that and what those organisations are doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I joined the OCDO, I'm sure it was 2017, but a while back. And as part of that, I had massive imposter syndrome. A lot, because like I said, I just didn't understand why the hell have I got this job? What could I possibly offer? And now looking back, I mean, we do this. We as dentists do not give ourselves enough credit for what we can offer. And dental hygienists and dental therapists, the whole team, we just think that we're there to just do the clinical side of it. But actually, we are a lot more than that. So, for instance, we're counsellors. You know, we listen. We are diagnosticians. We are radiographers. We're radiologists. We're business people. We're entrepreneurs. We're pioneers. We're scientists. We're artists. We have, you know, we negotiate. We can calm people down. We deal with anxieties. We deal with staffing issues. We're diplomats. All these things, all these transferable skills that we have that we do not give ourselves credit for. So, hell yeah, why the hell wouldn't OCDO want more clinicians from the ground? Why wouldn't there be more clinicians in commissioning roles? Why wouldn't there be? Because not only are we doing the do, but we have these skills that are applicable to different worlds and different areas, and not just dentistry. You know, I'm sure that dentists could make great consultants generally in the banking industry and in, you know, in other services. So when I started at OCDO, one of the first things that I just absolutely loved was the clinical fellow scheme. So the medics and the pharmacists had this national clinical fellow scheme associated with their chief medical officer and the chief pharmaceutical officer. So I set about establishing and creating a scheme for the chief dental officer in conjunction with FMLM, which is the Faculty of Medical Leadership and Management. And what that would offer is somebody the chance to spend a year understanding the fabric of dentistry. So who all these different organizations are and how they all fit together into this sort of jigsaw puzzle, who all these societies are. So what the wider world of dentistry looks like and how it all pieces together, as well as how that then pieces together into the wider healthcare system. That to me is invaluable. Everybody should go onto that clinical fellow scheme. And each clinician is affiliated with a host organization. So at that point, I think it was, so the GDC were well on board. We had CQC, we had the BSA, we had HEE, we had OCDO, or there were some others. Oh, BUPA. And it was wonderful. It was, we put together the interviewing process, and it's still going on today. I saw some of the fellows on Tuesday. So it's wonderful that to me is one of the legacies. It was one of my most favorite things that came out of OCDO for me during my time. There was a lot of work with ministers and such like. And then it becomes a blur because COVID hits. And being at the OCDO during COVID was, it's almost, you know, I do feel sometimes there is an element of a very mild PTSD. It was just a horrendous time. Everything was moving so quickly and things were changing and there were, you know, everyone was on edge. We didn't know what to, we couldn't get things out fast enough. I was seeing it on the ground, which is where my primary concern was, because I was a scared practitioner on the ground. And I wanted some form of plan or what is going to happen or what is happening. And so I was hearing it from the ground and friends and colleagues and family that were like, what is going on? Are we going to be shut down? Are we going to shut the practices down? Are we going to have a lockdown? So there was that going on one side. And then the other side of it was from the top end, not necessarily the top end, to the other end of the spectrum. I don't think it needs to be hierarchical, but on the other end of the spectrum where it was, you know, we're trying to deal with policy, we're trying to deal with, you know, what will happen, the ramifications of this, you know, all the vitriol that was going on in between, or the horrible, you know, messaging and the misogyny that was going out and the abuse that was being held, Sarah Hurley, which was, abuse was, I can understand people's frustration, anger. There's no two ways about that. I was frustrated. I was angry. I was scared. So anger, frustration stems from fear. So I get that. But the way that our profession conducted itself was appalling. And it was vile.
I suppose, in fairness to these people, and I think COVID has been a very challenging time. There's no doubt about it. But I think that we often hear, you know, this is unprecedented.
Yeah.
You know, that is a word that we mustn't lose sight of at times like this. And so, I mean, we could almost do a whole podcast on COVID, couldn't we?
God, yeah.
And actually, you know, we've been there. You know, I'd like to think that we're coming through the other side. I think it must have been very hard to be at the office for the chief dental officer at that time, and hard for everybody who was working clinical dental practice. It just must have been hard. But I do think we have learned things.
Yeah.
So I think let's try and bring that back to a sort of positive slant, that actually it was hard. We've been through it. We're going to go through it again with different things in our lifetime, and let's embrace it.
It was that unprecedented, that fact that it had never been done before. I just don't think people stop to take a breath to think that this is unprecedented. People are working hard and people are working around the clock.
Yeah.
What I have an issue with is misogyny. And the way that I saw firsthand, the way that she was treated comparatively to other leaders, other male leaders, I don't think they got the sort of abuse and language that was held at them as she did. And were she If it were a male CDO, you wouldn't use that sort of language with a male. So that was disappointing, but that more than disappointing, but give that to one side, it was just a very fast paced, everything's changed on a day to day environment.
And I really don't think anybody would disagree with you. I think it was a moment in time we will never, ever forget.
Oh, God, no. And it was during that time. So that was all going on, right? That's all going on. That's to set the scene, the context. And we were in a lockdown. And then we have yet another black man killed in the US at the hands of white police officers. And it became this sort of global, right, this is enough now. He went into a shop and he gave over a fake $20 bill, right? It wasn't like so armed robbery, sexual violence. He gave a $20 bill over to a shopkeeper. They called the cops and a policeman leant on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds while he was pleading for his mother and killed him and murdered him. So the anger and the whole movement, that is Black Lives Matters movement, the way that there were protests here, and obviously if you're going to go to the protest, you are breaking the laws of lockdown. So to me, I couldn't understand why people were doing that. It's like, why would you go on protest? We're in a lockdown. What are you doing? It was when I took the time to speak to a colleague at OCDO who is just one of the most straight, an introverted character at the OCDO, just a lovely, lovely person. And she told me she went to one of these. And I was so surprised. I was just so surprised. I just never would have thought she would. And I was like, why would you do that? Why would you do that? You broke the... And she went, Nish, enough is enough. Enough is enough. And I sort of heard her story. And she said the words that just because I carry it well doesn't mean that the burden isn't heavy. And it was just...
And so this started your diversity in dentistry.
Action group, that's right. So at that time, I was like, well, what are we doing as a profession to support? So you could see everybody was... sort of pledging something towards BLM and, you know, putting out written statements. Everybody from Heinz and BMW and Mercedes and, you know, everybody, the BMA, everybody. And what did we offer? You know, just deadly silence. And I thought, as a profession, why are we not saying something? Or why are we not doing something? And it was like the blinkers were off. And it was, we have a massive issue within dentistry. There is a significant disproportionate underrepresentation of black dentists and black people in dentistry. How did I not see that? Because I always used to think, well, dentistry is really diverse. Yes, it is for me, for people like me. We're doing quite well at the moment. But it's not to everybody. It's not equally. And why is that? So the DDAG was founded in May 2020. Under the watchful eye of Sarah, she was like, yeah, I think this is something that we should support as the OCDO. It's pan-professional. We invited stakeholders across the board, and it was humbling how successful it was. I thought if we could get a couple of, you know, if we could get some key players on board, if we could get the BDA on board, if we could get the GDC, oh no, we have currently 41 stakeholders, and we're talking specialist societies, we're talking BSDHT, we're talking BADN, SBDN, the defence organisations.
41.
So many,
41
of them.
41 stakeholders.
And, it was wonderful. Yeah. It was so lovely for people to say, yeah, we agree with, and what does that mean to agree? They help... support a report that we released. We try and hold as many meetings as we can as full stakeholders to talk about the elephant in the room, which is discrimination, which people just find uncomfortable for whatever reason. And I'm passionate about the DDAG, which I'm still very much a part of, I'm chair of even now. Outside of the OCDO, we're now hosted by the College of General Dentistry because there is much work to do. There is much work to do. And it doesn't have to be. The spotlight was on race at that time, but we're talking about all discriminatory factors. And at the moment, I think the biggest discriminatory factor is we are classist, we're elitist. We have massive barriers to kids from, you know, normal normal from state schools that want to get into dentistry. We have massive barriers to the way that we are not treating patients equally.
But those barriers are coming down, and I would urge you to listen to one of our guests that's going to be on this podcast, because she really has doing some groundbreaking stuff on education and trying to take down those barriers. So I think our listeners will look forward to that episode too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good.
So it's really inspiring to hear that story and those things that you've gone on to do. But there might be people listening that want to think about what they can do within their own practice. They might not be able to go out and do something more formal. So what advice would you give to our listeners in terms of making everyday changes in what they're doing?
When it comes to the DDAG, the work that we are doing, championing, it's more, see, my what I want to turn the spotlight more towards is us as a profession. I feel that we are discriminating on a day-to-day basis against our patients. So at the moment, when we look at all the studies, so the Dental Leadership Network the other day, the GDC on Tuesday, there was a report that was shown, and everybody's not in the same boat. When they keep saying patients are being denied access, or patients left in pain, the majority of that demographic are patients from deprived areas and patients from ethnic minorities and young patients. So I think it's time to call a spade, as in we're not talking about, oh, patients have been denied access. Well, the Bentley drivers aren't, you know, it's people of a certain demographic that are. And if we are a profession, a healthcare profession, how can it be that we are ourselves discriminate against certain people? How is that okay? And what are we as a profession doing to fight that? Because someone's got to champion that. Who's championing it? Why is it okay that if my son's in trouble, in pain, I know I could get him to see, someone could see him. I know we could. And if it means having to pay the money, I know we could do it. But maybe my neighbour couldn't. That's not right. And it's not right that as a healthcare, we're not offering access to all equally, that it's becoming more and more sort of privatized or elitist. I just don't know if that's the sort of healthcare profession that we should be in, you know? It does become that burden, that the burden, it becomes heavier and heavier, because what can I possibly do? What can we possibly do to change it? What can I possibly do to change it apart from raise people's awareness and raise the awareness of, you know, practitioners on the ground? If someone's in pain, just see them. You don't have to do thousands of pounds worth of work, just see them and get them out of pain. Surely, as a skill set, something that I can do, I can't ask, oh, George, can you get someone out of pain, please? It's not his skill set. Yeah. But if we have that skill set and we're able to do it, why don't we just do it? Because why don't we just do it? And it takes half an hour to extirpate. It takes half an hour to extract a tooth. I don't know how we can keep laying that responsibility down to those who won't pick up the baton, because nothing's going to change anytime soon. And then what sort of society do we want to live in then? One that's just, well, you know, if you've got the money, otherwise that's horrible. But yeah, like I say, I don't know how much DDAG can champion that.
I think that people can't they? I think, like you say, it's that whole thing of awareness, and you don't know what you don't know. And I think if people are made to think, consider, reflect, go on to action,
yeah,
I think that then you've done your job. I mean, and that's why we've got you on this podcast, because actually we do value your opinion. We've heard a great deal about little elements. I say little elements, they're huge elements of what you've been doing in your career. But I'm interested to know really what you're doing currently, literally as we speak. What's your working week like at the moment?
Okay, so I chose to leave the OCDO. Oh my goodness, it's been about a year and a half. I spoke to Sarah and saying I felt that I was suffering from burnout big time at that time. I was exhausted. I was working 6 days a week at that time. So I've never stopped clinical dentistry for 20 years now. And at that time, yeah, the policy and a work and the such like and being a review, and it just became too much. It all came to a head when one day I realised what a rubbish mum I was being. That was an eye-opener for me. So I was going through their drawers, going through their underwear, actually. And I realised my daughter at that time was, what, 10? And she was wearing eight-year-old underwear. And it's really hit home for me. Like, why is she wearing, how was I not seeing this? Why was I so busy pretending to be important when the people to whom I really am important were just being neglected? And it was hard for me to accept that somewhere I had failed, and I felt like I was failing being a mum. So I did speak to Sarah, and she did allow a 6-month sabbatical, which was really what I needed to get my head put back on and get my headspace in the right arena again. I just needed time out. I think that everybody really does need to acknowledge that sometimes you just need time out, and it's not being a failure when you need to do that. It's fine to sometimes think, you know what, I just need a duvet day. I just need to stay in bed. I need to do nothing today. And that's fine to do that. I think the legacy of the pandemic has left people, lots of people with all sorts of diagnosed and undiagnosed mental health issues and ways of, you know, people really did enjoy, some people really enjoyed that time off. They really did. Some people, it was the worst thing ever. But we all have varying degrees of how we dealt with the pandemic. And the aftermath that now, for me, is, what's my working week like? Still clinical. More time with my children, presentations and podcast addresses. So immediately in the next hour, I will be presenting downstairs. For the BDA, I went to the Dental Leadership Network. I love presenting. I love going to institutions and being invited to talk to them about all things EDI. I'm not an expert on it, but what I have done is become aware of my own, and I've got loads of them, of my own prejudices, my own biases, my own, you know, I talk about how I went to dental school and how disgruntled I was by all these rich people. That's my own prejudice. I had a prejudice against wealthy people. I thought, oh God, and it goes both ways, you know. It's the oddest thing. I have a working class mind and working class background, but I am well and truly middle class. You know, I've been shoved into this arena of, I love the theatre. I love the fact I can take my children on a holiday 3 times a year. It's a crazy kind of mindset where I will still champion the rights of it. I'm a lefty at heart, yet my kids go to a private school. I mean, how do I fix that in my own head? How do I
Your story about your own mental health, I think, is very refreshing to hear, and your description of your bias situation and to be honest about it. And I think that's something that's a great privilege to hear. And I think that we need to sort of share these stories, don't we, to say that actually things aren't all right. And I think that's probably one of the best things that's come out of COVID, that actually people truly, when you say, how are you, people actually are now saying, hey, I'm okay, or actually, I'm not okay. Mm-hmm. So for all of our discussions about COVID and all of the things that went on in dentistry, I do find that my conversations that I have with my patients, with my colleagues, with my friends and family, I think people are being more honest about their emotions. And I think that's a really good thing. So I think the fact that you've been happy to talk about your things, I think has been really helpful.
It needs, there is so much to be said on mental health in dentistry, so much. And it is okay to not be okay. Absolutely. That is, it's, you can have days where you can cry for a whole week and that's okay if that's what you need to do. And crying's great. You know, releases serotonin. There's a reason why you cry. It makes you feel better afterwards.
And you taking and 6 months off was obviously,
you know, was big. It was massive. It was just, I started off thinking I'm a failure. Why have I taken time off work? What am I doing? This is terrible. I was still clinical, like I say, but it was just I needed a break from the office, and I needed a break from things where I was missing the beauty of my life, and I just didn't see it. I was just so busy, honestly, or busy pretending to be important. That wasn't important. What was important was these two little beings that are growing up seeing mummy work hard, which I think is really important for the kids, my kids, to know that mummy works hard, but mummy has got time for them as well. And they're not mutually exclusive. You know, I have got time for you too. I mean, this is a big one that I share is when I walked into the front room one day and they were all watching. They're watching Marvel, I'm sure. Marvel's a big thing in our house. And they're watching a film and they're like, yay, there was a cheer. There was a cheer because mummy is joining them to watch a film. I mean, how depressing is that?
And, you know, we're talking about you as a mother, but I think, again, we could be talking about male.
Absolutely.
You know, fathers doing this. I just think we just need to be a bit kind to ourselves, don't we?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what job you're doing in dentistry. It's hard. It's hard being nice to people all day. Yeah. It's hard doing that clinical work. Yeah. It's hard bending over.
It is.
I think let's just be kind to ourselves. And if that means doing whatever you need to do, then let's embrace it.
It's just to be kinder as people, to be kinder to ourselves, to our patients, to our backs, to all the things that we miss when we think that's what it is to be a dentist. There are so many things that we overlook. And to me, to be a dentist is just to be a good person going through life and seeing the beauty of it. We're in such a privileged position. We're in such a privileged position. We have wonderful people that we work with. We have team members. And we are entrusted by the public to do what we do. And it's to embrace that and know that, you know what, we're okay. We're actually okay.
Nishma, I think we've barely scratched the surface. There's so many more things that we want to talk about. But I think that's a really great way to end. And I think there's lots of take-home messages there. There's lots of things for people to think about. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It's been a privilege having you on the podcast.
Thank you both. Thank you very much.
If you've been inspired by that episode, did you know that the Eastman Dental Hospital Education Centre provide training for the whole dental team? Follow us on social media or search for the Eastman Dental Hospital Education Centre to find out more.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. We would love to hear your suggestions for future guests. Remember to follow us on social media using hashtag the Eastman Dental Podcast. And if you like what you hear, please like, share, subscribe, and listen out for future episodes.